The purpose of this recording is to provide some practical help for students of classical Latin, both elementary and advanced, who wish to learn to pronounce the language in approximately the way it was pronounced in the classical period of the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD in Rome. This method of pronouncing Latin is called the restored historical pronunciation, or more briefly, the restored pronunciation of classical Latin. Two questions can be raised at once. First, how can we know how classical Latin was actually pronounced? Second, why is it important to take the time to learn the pronunciation of a language that today is rarely spoken? Before I attempt to answer these questions, perhaps I might say a word about the linguistic background of the Latin language. Classical Latin is a member of the Indo-European family of languages, a family that includes Sanskrit, the Germanic languages, including English, the Slavic languages, and ancient Greek. It is only natural, then, that classical Latin shares certain features of vocabulary, of grammar, and of pronunciation, not only with the Romance languages, which are directly derived from Latin, but also with other modern languages such as Russian, German, and English. Classical Latin is, so to speak, a linguistic relative of our own English language. Actually, the Latin language itself was not a simple, unchanging structure. It had variations that depended upon its chronological development. For example, the literary language of the classical 1st century AD clearly differed in certain respects from the language of the poems of Ennius, which were composed in the 2nd century BC, though there is scanty evidence concerning the pronunciation of this pre-classical Latin. In turn, classical Latin of the 1st centuries BC and AD differed considerably from the post-classical Latin that developed in the Middle Ages, and that is generally referred to as medieval Latin. In this case, we do have evidence to document the linguistic changes, including that of the pronunciation. These chronological changes in the Latin language are in no way unique or surprising. Every language of which we have historical information, including our own English, has undergone major changes in structure and pronunciation through the centuries. Despite these chronological variations, in our study of the pronunciation of Latin, we shall concentrate, as I said at the beginning, on the pronunciation of classical Latin of the 1st centuries BC and AD, a period that represents the summit of Latin literary achievement. Let us return now to our two basic questions. First, how can we know today how classical Latin was actually pronounced? After all, Cicero and Virgil did not use tape recorders, as you obviously are at this very moment. True enough. But modern linguists have many clear sources of information concerning the pronunciation of classical Latin. First of all, we have the testimony of ancient Roman grammarians and other writers who frequently give a precise description concerning specific aspects of pronunciation. For example, the grammarian Marius Victorinus, in describing the sound of the letter R, says rather vividly, "By vibrating the tip of the tongue against the palate, the letter R gives a thunderous noise with rapid blows." There is little doubt that the thunderous noise with rapid blows is what we call, less picturesquely, the trill of the R, a trill being a sound produced with a rapid vibration of any movable speech organ. The rhetorician Quintilian, discussing the letter M, says, "When M ends a word and is in contact with an initial vowel of the next word, that is, in a position of elision, although the letter M is written, it is hardly pronounced, so that it gives the sound almost of a new letter. The M here is not omitted," says Quintilian, "but is obscured, obscuratur." Thus, the strong evidence from Quintilian, corroborated by grammarians such as Velius Longus and Priscian, clearly points to the nasalization of final M with the lips apart, as in the French nasalized final M. It also points to the fact that this nasalization was heard in cases of elision of final M. The particular words referred to above by Quintilian are written out in full as multum ille. They appear in the third line of the Aeneid and were probably pronounced something like multuille. But more on final M later. Another important source of information concerning pronunciation comes from the representation or the transliteration of classical Latin into other ancient languages. Thus, when the names of Caesar and Cicero were transcribed into Greek, the first letter of each of these names was always written with a kappa, the sound of g. If the name of Cicero had been pronounced Cicero, the Greeks would have used for the S sound their letter sigma rather than kappa. Here we have clear and simple proof that the letter C in classical Latin was always hard, g, and that the names of the famous Romans in question were pronounced Caesar and Cicero. We have numerous other sources of information concerning the pronunciation of classical Latin, such as puns, wordplay, and graffiti. We also have the various linguistic developments in the Romance languages, but there is not sufficient time to discuss each of these now. We can, however, say that linguists today all over the world, on the basis of clear and convincing evidence, are in general agreement about how classical Latin of the 1st century BC and the 1st century AD was pronounced. Our second basic question was, why is it important to take the time to learn the correct pronunciation of a language that today is rarely spoken? The answer to this question involves the very nature of classical Latin literature. Let me simply state here that absolutely none of the works of classical Latin literature was intended for individual and silent book reading in the modern manner. At the time when classical Latin literature was composed, relatively few people owned books, since a book had to be copied by hand onto a papyrus or a parchment roll, a long and expensive procedure. The process of poetic communication consisted of the flow of sound from the lips of the poet to the ears of his assembled audience without the intermediary of the written or the printed word. And so, we learn that when young Terence wished to submit his new play to the judgment of the veteran playwright Caecilius, he did not send it through the mail, but came to the old master's house and read it to him in person. Likewise, when the ruling Augustus became impatient to see how the Aeneid was progressing, Virgil did not dispatch him a copy by messenger, or leave the princeps to browse through the poem silently and alone, but he came in person and read him three books, just as he had previously done with the Georgics. Ovid tells us how Propertius used to recite his poems to him, how his ears were enthralled by listening to Horace, and how he used to read his own works publicly. We are informed by the grammarian, Aelius Donatus, that Virgil's eclogues were read with great effect in the theatre. Finally, it should be recalled that even in those cases where someone did own a book of poetry, the owner of the book would always read the poetry to himself out loud. It was only hundreds of years later, well into the Common Era, that our practice of silent reading began. In classical Latin literature, then, the element of sound is of central importance. Obviously, a correct pronunciation of classical Latin is crucial to a full and valid literary experience. An incorrect pronunciation will presumably vitiate or at least distort this experience. You know, there is a famous sonnet of Shakespeare that begins, "Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds," and so on. Imagine the case of a Frenchman who declares his passionate admiration for the sonnets of Shakespeare, particularly the one, he says, that begins, "Let me not to the mariage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, ma chérie." I think you would agree with me that our Frenchman, despite his understanding of the meaning and of the sentiments of the verse, is losing an essential element of Shakespeare's poetry by his producing and hearing the wrong music. But in order not to be unfair to any Frenchman or Francophile who may be listening, you know there is a famous poem of Paul Verlaine which begins, "Il pleure dans mon cœur comme il pleut sur la ville." Now, just imagine the case of the American who declares his passionate admiration for the poems of Verlaine, particularly that one, he says, that begins, "Il pleure dans mon cœur comme il pleut sur la ville." Well, it seems to me that we do something fairly similar with Virgil and the other Roman authors when we read their works with the traditional and incorrect pronunciation. Perhaps a specific illustration will make this point clear. Let's listen to the first 7 lines of the Aeneid read with 2 different pronunciations. First with the traditional Latin pronunciation, then with the restored historical pronunciation. It might be helpful to listen to this section while looking at the Latin text of Virgil, which is printed in the accompanying booklet, although I think the principal differences in sound will be readily apparent to the ears alone. The first rendition of Virgil that you will hear will be done with the traditional Latin pronunciation, which is still generally taught in most American schools and colleges today. You will notice in this traditional pronunciation that the letter R is not trilled, but is given the English or American pronunciation. Final M is here pronounced with the lips together, rather than nasalized with lips apart. Double consonants such as double L, double S, and double R are pronounced as if they were single. Here is a traditional rendition. "Arma virumque cano Troiae qui primus aboris, Italiam fato profugus la vignaque venit, litora multileteris iactatus et alto, vi superum saevae memorem iunones ob iram, multa quoque bello passus tum conderet urbem. Inferretque deos latiogenus unde latinum. Albanique patres at qual taimonia Romae." You notice that the rhythm in this reading is based on an automatic stressing of the first long syllable of each measure, a procedure that completely distorts the natural accents of many of the words. No Roman in his right mind, or tongue, said cano or Troiae. The normal Latin pronunciation of these words is cano and Troiae. The second rendition will use the restored historical pronunciation of Latin. Here the attempt is made, first of all, to give to the various vowels and consonants, including R, final M, and the double consonants, their correct values. Secondly, to make use of the natural word accents. And finally, to integrate these accents with the rhythmic patterns based upon syllabic quantity rather than upon syllabic stress. Here is a reading in the restored pronunciation. armavi runque canu, Troiae qui primus saboris, Italian fato profugus, la vigna que venit litora, multo ille terris iactatus et alto, vi superon saevae memoran iunones obiran. Multa quoquet bello passus tum condere turba, inferretque deos latio, genus unde latino, albanique patris, at qualtae moenia Romae. Although I do not have the illusion that the use of the restored historical pronunciation will permit me or anyone today to achieve precisely the pronunciation and intonation that Virgil, Horace, or Cicero gave to their works, we can achieve a good approximation. Again, one might ask, why bother at all? My answer is that, far more important even than the question of historical accuracy and of honestly making the best of our knowledge, is the question of aesthetic truth. Archaeologists and art historians carefully gather together and study the broken pieces of marble at the foot of the Parthenon, and then restore whatever knowledge permits in order to give us as clear an image as possible of the temple's original beauty. In just the same way, linguists and literary scholars carefully gather evidence and restore as much as possible of the authentic pronunciation of classical Latin for a reason that is as simple as it is profound. Since all of the Roman authors created their works in the framework of a flow of sound from author to listener, it is clear that the closer we can come to hearing the authentic sound of classical Latin, the closer we will come to perceiving the original beauty and the aesthetic essence of the Latin literary creation. And now to the theory and the practice of the pronunciation and reading of classical Latin. In the next part of this recording, I shall deal with the three principal components of the pronunciation: the vowels and consonants, the word accents, and the poetic rhythms. My aim here will be not to give an exhaustive linguistic treatment, but simply to provide a clear and reliable basis for practical use. For this reason, some details of lesser importance will be omitted from my presentation. For those who wish to have a fully detailed linguistic explanation of this material, I recommend the excellent book of W. S. Allen, entitled Vox Latina, spelled V-O-X-L-A-T-I-N-A, and subtitled A Guide to the Pronunciation of Classical Latin. This recording is highly indebted to Professor Allen's works for many points of linguistic clarification. In our treatment of the sounds of the vowels and consonants in classical Latin, of the stress accents, and of the poetic rhythms, a most useful concept to keep in mind is that of distinctions in sound. Every language has its own particular pattern of distinctions in sound, some of which may also exist in other languages, some may not. In English, for example, we do have a clear distinction between the final consonants of the two words gun and gum. The final consonant of the first word, gun, we call a dental nasal. The final consonant of the second word, gum, we call a bilabial nasal. Linguists refer to this phenomenon as a phonemic distinction between the two consonants, a phoneme being defined as a minimum unit of distinctive sound feature. Native speakers of English usually have no difficulty in hearing and producing distinctive N's and M's, since they have grown up in a linguistic environment in which this phonemic distinction is an integral part of the language. Classical Latin, however, had a somewhat different pattern of phonemic distinctions. For example, in addition to having the same phonemic distinction between N and M as that in English, classical Latin, as we shall soon see in detail, also had a distinction in sound between an M at the beginning or middle of a word, M, and a final M, M, a sound which represents a nasalization of M with the lips held apart, as we previously heard. What we must do in learning to pronounce any foreign language correctly is first to become mentally aware of those phonemic distinctions in the foreign language that do not exist in our own native language, then to sensitize our ears to detect these new phonemic distinctions when pronounced by others, and finally, to try to reproduce these phonemic distinctions ourselves when pronouncing the foreign language. What I have just said about phonemic distinctions as applied to certain sounds in classical Latin is, I imagine, quite clear to anyone who has studied a modern foreign language, for the principles are precisely the same. However, the concept of distinctions in sound will be applied to one element of classical Latin that is not found in the commonly studied modern foreign languages, the poetic rhythms, based upon syllabic quantity. In the rhythms of Latin poetry, which are based upon the length or duration of the syllables, there is no absolute length to a syllable that is classified as long, and no absolute time value to a syllable classified as short. All that matters is that the listener be able to hear a clear distinction in quantity or duration of time between long and short syllables. That is, that certain syllables are long or short in relation to one another, and not to any absolute time value. In all of these aspects of the pronunciation of classical Latin, then, it is the discernible distinction of sounds that is of primary importance. I think it would be helpful in our treatment of the pronunciation of classical Latin vowels and consonants to proceed from the known to the unknown. As I mentioned at the beginning of our discussion, classical Latin, as a linguistic relative of English, has many sounds that do have close counterparts in modern English. Let's begin then with a quick review of those letters and sounds of classical Latin that do have close equivalents to sounds represented by letters of the modern English alphabet. Please feel free at any time during the discussions that follow to stop the recording in order to listen again to certain passages or to practice and review the material that has been presented. The advanced student is, of course, invited to skip or to proceed more rapidly over material with which he or she is already familiar.